she loves them. It's going to be a ballerina. It's December 4th, 1993. I'm interviewing Lori Knapp in her home in Bell's Flats, Kodiak, Alaska, and here to talk about how she came to Kodiak and how she was involved in fishing. Hi, Lori. How did you first come to Alaska?
Well, my sister and her husband came up here originally. Her husband was an architect and worked for an architectural firm in Anchorage, and I came out of high school and flew up from Minneapolis and joined them up here and worked for an outfit called Bering Sea Originals, painting Alaskan scenes on pottery, and got real anxious to see the rest of Alaska, so I put my backpack on and traveled around a bit and ended up in Seward, working for Seward Fisheries, which after 2 months of the Fraulein telling me, work with both hands, don't sing, do this, do that, I got real tired of that and the wages, and I began to realize how much money they were making on boats, so I tried to get on some boats with no luck on Seward, and I ended up on the ferry one night to Kodiak, because I guess I was drinking in the bar, and I had joined the King Crab Festival, running one of the booths that you throw the balls and hit the little dolls, and so that's how I ended up at Kodiak. And from there I worked in a couple of canneries around town and did a little beach sanding, a little set netting for a summer out in Raspberry Island, and then the summer of 1976 I jumped on the Callista Sea. I went down and asked a friend, Toby Gillis, if his skipper would need somebody, and he did. Gary Stewart hired me on the Callista Sea. It's owned by the Callista Corporation out of Anchorage. And skipper said, go pack a couple of things, or go pack your bags. And so I went home and threw a few things in a little bag and thought we were fishing around the island. But as it turned out, we left the end of the island heading to the Bering Sea. And what bay are we fishing in? And they all laughed and got a big kick out of that and told me, oh, it's a big one. So we ended up in the Bering Sea for the rest of the year. And on my way out there, I was cleaning out the forepeak. And I found a case of baseball bats, and that kind of struck my curiosity. I thought, gee, these guys just play a lot of baseball. They have a case of baseball bats. So they got a lot of laughs out of me that first few trips, and told me I'd find out what the baseball bats were all about, which I did.
And in those days, how long was the season? You were going out for king crab.
Well, yeah, king crab began in the fall and lasted for about 2 or 3 months. Uh-huh. And then that went right into tanner season, and it lasted all through the winter. And people would quit about in the spring, although several years after that I began fishing crab year round. They had divided up the species into bardais and apelios, and we'd fish the apelios during the summer. So we began fishing year round.
Did you enjoy the work?
Yeah. It was still romantic to me. It was still just this big adventure, and the money was fabulous, and I don't know, the stories and the wildness, and it was just like something out of some novel.
Uh-huh. How long did you stay on the Callista Sea?
I lasted with them for a couple of years until the Callista Corporation got a new skipper, and that's about the time I got together with my first husband, Steve Illich, and we began running boats for Tom Fox out of Seattle, and also for Blake Kinnear. And we ran those boats year-round, Lynn Jay and the Andromeda.
Were there very many women fishing in the 70s?
No, hardly any women at all. Peggy Smith, and one other gal, Crystal, I don't remember her last name, but were the only two women I knew, other than a couple of Norwegian women who were relatives that were on as cooks, and there was no women out on deck at that time.
Were you on deck?
I wasn't until I started working for my husband, and then I finally had the nerve to... It's difficult because there were times where I would go up to the rail and bring a crab pot aboard on one boat the first trip, and all the guys started screaming, look out, look out! And I'm looking all around, and they there's a woman at the rail. And I go, oh, geez, you know. and yet there was other men I worked with that were very supportive and in fact let me run the boat and, you know, run crab gear and while they worked on deck. And
How much of a crew share did you get when you first went out?
It was a wage of $100 a day, and then it worked into, you know, 8-9%.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
What was the most money you ever made, say, in a season or on a trip? Or, I mean, was there ever...
That was for Jack Beavis, and that was a halibut fishery in Kodiak here in 1976, and that was $6,000 in a 40-hour opening.
Wow. So you came back eventually, I mean, you fished crab through the years and fished other things?
Swordfish off of Mexico and herring in southeastern and shrimp and salmon. Most notably for Mary Jacobs, which was probably the most fun summer I ever had, because I guess because it was all women and it was just a lot of fun. You didn't have to put up with some of the stuff you have to put up with men on boats.
Did women who got jobs on boats, did they have to put out for the skipper to get a job?
No, not that I know of. I was never asked. I was asked maybe a few times while we were out there, but they didn't get very far.
Did you find that there was a lot of, maybe resentment towards women on boats by the crew members? I don't know if resentment's the right word, but maybe prejudice that women can't do the
Definitely
job.
Prejudice, not resentment. Prejudiced. I think being threatened a lot, too, because women are very good at controls, running hydraulics. They have a much steadier hand than a lot of men do.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have the brute force, but you know, geez, you have all the hydraulics and
mm-hmm.
and running a boat and electronics and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Were there women on boats who were wives and girlfriends? You mentioned the Norwegians, but as the years went on, were more and more women?
Yes, a lot more, especially the 80s, you know, there was a lot more women, you know, in the cannery, they would see this and see some of us out there, and then, you know, we got around, yeah. A lot of the college people would come up and beat the dogs, a lot of boys and girls.
Mm-hmm. Tell me again about when you went out to the Bering Sea. How did you find out what the baseball bats were for on that trip?
It was some pretty rugged storms that winter. There was one storm that... I would hold myself in by the armrests on the chair in the pilot house as we were going down the wave. And he would throttle down as we were going down the wave and then throttle up to keep the speed the same consistently. And these waves, I found out later, were 70-foot waves. And boats had windows knocked out, overhangs bent down, rigging torn off. Nobody killed that I know of in that particular storm, but you know, a lot of boats have been lost in storms just like that. And you get to a point where you have to turn and just go with the wind. You can't fight it. If you're out in the middle, there's nothing you can do. There's nowhere to hide.
Mm-hmm. So you just ride out the storm. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Beat you to death.
Head for Nome, depending which way the wind is blowing.
Mm-hmm. What was the worst storm, or what was you the most scared?
That was it. And I wasn't really scared. I mean, I was so young. And really didn't know about, you know, when you're young, you don't think about dying.
You were how old then?
Well, let's see, 76, so it's 20 years ago, so I was 37 now, 17, 18.
18, my goodness. Yeah. I read the book by Spike Walker, Living on the Edge, and he mentions that as the progression of the king crab fishery through the years, say into the mid-80s, at pretty high times, were had by a lot of people. People wasted money on drug habits. How was that, how did that affect the fishery or the people that you knew who were fishing? Was there a different attitude or were people wild and crazy? Or?
Oh yeah, a lot of people, you know, just you see so much money coming in and just incredible crew shares. And it goes to their head, and also that you get into the, I don't know if macho is the right word, but this wildness that goes on in the bars when you come to town, and it's really hard to not be into it. It's so much fun, and then people there were drugs and people would take them and have a good time, and having a good time, why not have a better time? And, you know, it leads to another, and mm-hmm. people just blew their money, you know, marijuana, cocaine, and you know, flying off to Hawaii, spend all your money and come back and go fishing again. Mm-hmm. You know, it looked endless.
In his book, Spike Walker tells stories about people who would go out who, like, had bowls of cocaine on the table and thinking they were Superman or something, in a way. Were there ever times when you saw people going out of, say, Dutch Harbor or out of Kodiak, when you wondered if the crew was so high, would they ever make it back? I mean, were there times...
Not in the boats that I was on.
I
saw that in port, mm-hmm. and there were times, you know, most skippers set, you know, times that you had to be straight. And most skippers kept a pretty good, that I, all the skippers that I worked with kept a pretty tight handle on that. There was some marijuana smoking on some of the boats I was on. No heavy drug use while you were fishing. You couldn't do it. It demanded, you know, all of your attention, all of the time, all of your strength, all of the time on deck.
Do you think there were a lot of myths or tales going on about wild and crazy times that were happening out at sea that were not true?
I don't know. You know, I know that a lot of young men did a lot of cocaine while they were working out there, you know, and I've seen a lot of them that burnt out and end up in detox centers or have lives ruined, or at least a lot of money go down the drain.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Mary Jacobs. Was she the only female skipper that you worked for?
Yes.
And is she still fishing?
All she does now is herring, and she leases her boat out for salmon season.
And would you say there are more women in the fishery now than when you were in the 70s and 80s?
Oh, definitely.
Why did you quit fishing and return to land?
Well, I met this guy, and we decided to have a few kids. I don't know if it was a decision, it just sort of happened. And so here I sit with my apron on.
Does age enter into the picture? Does not being 17?
Oh. Well, let's see. I quit when I was 34, and I at that point I still didn't feel old. I only felt old after I had kids.
What advice would you give a woman who wanted to get into fisheries today, or into fishing?
Well, be patient and, you know, keep your eyes and your ears open and watch a lot that's going on. If you've never fished before, never been out to sea, my first few years while I was out on the Bering Sea, I did a lot of standing against the bulkhead out in deck and watching what was going on, because it's very dangerous. Things happen very fast, and it's always something different. Nothing ever happens the same. And you really need to keep an eye open. It's good to have a, you know, good handle on knots and how to handle gear, how to handle things on boats, you know, tying up, that sort of thing.
Okay. Is there anything else that I haven't brought up that you'd like to talk about? Because you talked a lot about women, and is there anything I'm leaving out? The fishing industry has changed in the last 20 years quite a bit. And the money in the Highliner days are older.
I guess all those smart women have gone into other jobs.
Had children.
And there isn't the money in the fisheries as there used to be. It's pretty nip and tuck anymore. The talk of the salmon season with 12 cents a pound for humpies, it's hardly worth even fishing for that. You know, they're still making some money dragging. But
what kind of money are they making out in Bering Sea now?
I don't know. I haven't.
I mean, the bonanza days might be over.
Well, for sure.
Did you ever fish in Bristol Bay?
Uh-huh.
For what?
For salmon.
Uh-huh. What kind of boat?
Little gillnetter, little high-speed little gillnetters.
With power?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a wild and crazy fishery. It's a very simple fishery. Just throw the nets out and the fish run into it. You know, there's a lot of people up there who are Californians and people from out of state who think they are, and not just them, but most people in that fishery think they're God's gift to the fishery, and they're very, very macho and
lots of men.
Yes, very hot-headed, fast-paced fishery, lots of money. You know, make a year's wage in a couple of months.
Mm-hmm. And so, how were you accepted as being a fisherwoman up there?
Well, you really don't see too many other people, really. My husband was up running a tender up there, and I got a job with a fellow who accepted me. As long as you can pick fish, man, that's fine. You know, if you can pick fish fast, then you're in it. That's all it takes up there. Mm-hmm. It really doesn't, you know, it's not much else. There isn't the elitism that there was in the Bering Sea crab fishery. You know, that was a very elite, snobby sort of attitude.
And of all the fishing that you've done, what you said that fishing with Mary was the most fun,
mm-hmm.
and that was the most mm-hmm. enjoyable. What was your worst experience?
Probably with Mary Jacobs.
So it's the best.
Tensions ran high. You'd get tired, and Karen Lee and Mary were at each other's throats, strangling each other, and that probably sticks in my mind the most, because to go from being the perfect crew, the perfect situation, making money, being happy, everybody vibed to do the work for somebody else, which you don't find on boats with men. They expect you to do carry all the menial jobs, you know, the cleaning up,
the woman,
cooking.
The woman.
Yes.
And who, you had four people on that boat or five?
Four.
And then, and who was your fourth person?
No, excuse me, five. There was Mary Jacobs, Karen Lee, myself, Jane Eisman, and a young girl, and I've forgotten her name, and then Peggy came on and took Karen's place at one point.
Hmm.
After Red Season, Peggy was on for Pink's.
So that was here in Kodiak?
That was here in Kodiak and up and down the peninsula on the mainland. So at one point during the Red Season in Igbeck, Mary and Karen had each other's hands around each other's... Nope. Mary had her hands around Karen's neck, and all I could do was stand there and say, Karen, 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 hoping that Karen wouldn't slug her, because I know that Karen would probably knock her right off the boat. So, yeah, tensions run high, and even with women, you know, it's you get aggressive. Yeah.
Thank you, Lori. It's been a pleasure to talk to you today.
Elements. So, that was probably the worst event. That wasn't the scariest. The scariest was tying yourself onto a rail and taking those baseball bats and beating the ice off so you didn't roll over. And you were fighting for your life minute by minute and never knowing if there's going to be an end to fighting your life for your life.
That was, you know, in the 70-foot waves? You were biting?
No, that wasn't in the 70-foot waves. It wasn't icing, fortunately, then. But when their icing conditions are bad, and you have to go out and do that for fear of rolling over, just like the icebergs do.
Wow.
And, you know, the big metal boat and all that spray coming up. And
did you ever worry about getting stuck in the ice up in the Bering Sea? Like, where,
no,
where
we never fished up that high, although some boats did. We never fished that far, far north.
How often did you go into port?
12 hours in port, or however long it took to unload, depending on how much the backup was of other boats, 12 hours to get out to the gear, 24 hours on the gear, running the gear nonstop, 12 hours back, and then unload.
So when did you sleep?
On the way to port, 12 hours.
12 hours. And when you say port, where was that?
Dutch Harbor.
Dutch Harbor.
Or Accutane.
And delivered to a processor or
yeah.
cannery?
Yeah, processors and shore-based canneries in Dutch Harbor, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Yeah, there were some wild times in that town. I can tell you.
Well, why don't you? Let's hear about some of those.
Okay, well, let's see. The first night I came into Dutch Harbor, Unisea had just opened, but we chose to go over to the other side, which is Unalaska, and went to the Elbow Room, which was a shoddy little bar, one-room bar. Actually, it had two rooms. It had the little blue room. So we went and sat in the blue room with the crew off the Calista Sea, and I'm sitting with my skipper, Gary Stewart, and the rest of the crew, and a native fellow came up and ripped off Gary Stewart's shoe and poured his drink in it and drank out of it, and I'm my jaw hanging open, but there was all sorts of little wild little things like that that went on. There was a woman, Fat Helen, who always came in and sat down to some next to some guy, some big fat woman, Native woman, little short, fat Native woman, and she would always choose her boyfriends, and it was hilarious.
Compare the Elbow Room, the size of it, to a barn in Kodiak.
Oh God, about the size of 10 times the size of a bathroom. I mean, it was pretty small.
Oh, so there was no Elbow Room. What did you do in your off time when the season closed, or it was time when the skipper wanted to go home, or whatever?
Well, either I was cleaning up the galley, because a lot of times you couldn't clean as you were coming in, it was too rough, or you were sleeping. In the bars, drinking, or preparing storm food, which is, you know, getting meals ready and freezing them. So I did a lot of that, so that when we're out there, we could pull something out of the freezer, microwave, and have it to eat.
Some people say that the microwave is the downfall of the health of the crab fishermen, because they never got enough chance to rest.
Oh, well, and there were those skippers that drove their crews, too, and would just get new crews when they needed, when they wore out the old crew. And I can't remember any boats offhand. Maybe Peggy and I sat down and beat brains together, you know, and she could come up with it. But that could be, you know.
In the fishery now, some boats take two crews, is that right? Where one's on deck and all the other sleeps?
Well, they have a couple extra where they could sleep while the other were working on deck, just a, you know, one or two extra, so you get another, you know, 4 hours of sleep or whatever.
Sounds grueling.
Yeah, it's grueling.
Well, to get back to the present, Lori, you have two children, two little girls. What are you doing? I see you're doing papier mache. Do you have aspirations of getting into artwork? Or?
You know, I probably keep that as a sideline, just because I never wanted to initially get into art, because I didn't want to depend on something creative. I didn't want to pressure that for money. And it's something I'd love to do on the side. Right now, with two little kids, you can't have too much expensive, you know, paper and everything out of there to just get into it. But so papier mache, they can help me do that, and that's fun. But the pinatas. But my big goal in life is to have a sailing freighter. My last husband and I had a small sailboat, which we kept in Puget Sound, and I sailed an awful lot by myself, you know, in through the ocean and in through the San Juans and whatnot, and I just fell in love with sailing.
Oh.
But going into a port not having anything to deliver was boring for me. I couldn't do it anymore. I had to go back fishing. I'd park the boat and go, okay, I'm getting ready to get back on the boat now. So I would love to have a sailing freighter, and I'd love to take troubled kids out and put them to work. That's my big one.
So exciting. Thank you, Lori. It's November 6th, 1993. I'm here to interview Roy Madsen about his life in Kodiak, in particular as it relates to the fishing industry. But first, tell me about your childhood. Where were you born and raised?
Well, I was born in a village on the Alaska Peninsula, not too far from Katmai National Monument, called Kinetic. And lived there until I was about 3 years old, and then my family moved to Kodiak. And my mother was originally from Kodiak, so it was home to her. And I was raised here in Kodiak, went to grade school and high school in Kodiak.
And your mother's maiden name was?
Matrokin.
Matrokin. So her family was here,
yeah.
And you had cousins, and you grew up with lots of family members?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh. And some uncles and lots of cousins.
Lots of cousins. Who were your brothers and sisters?
Well, there were eight in our family. I had a brother Alf and a brother Elizabeth and Rose, Thelma Johnson, and then myself, and then a sister Alice. And my mother died when Alice was an infant, about a year and a half old, and when my father remarried a lady by the name of Alexandria Chernoff, and I had a half sister and a half brother, Raymond and Jermaine, and my stepmother was related to the Hubley family. Mrs. Hubley was her sister, Mrs. Norton was her sister, Mrs. Scholl was her sister. With quite a large family. So that kind of extended our family in other directions with that marriage, because we were all kind of considered related.
Mm-hmm.
Even though not by blood, by marriage, we were very close.
Uh-huh. Did you always live in the town of Kodiak, or did you ever live out in the villages?
Well, we always lived in the town, but we used to travel to hunting camps in different days.
Okay, you mentioned that you sometimes went out of town to go to the bear camps.
Yes, my father was in the guiding business, became guiding business, and he had bear camps in Mush Bay and Ugani and at Karlick Lake, and we used to travel out to the bear camps in the spring for the spring hunts and also in the fall of the year.
Did you go out hunting with them, or were you did you remain mostly in camp with your mom and your sisters?
Well, my father first started taking me out when I was 11 years old, and I stayed in the camp until I was about 14 or 15, and then I started going out when I was probably about 14 or 15 years old. I used to go out on the hunts with them, actually, and I would carry extra jackets and binoculars and things like that.
Sort of the gopher.
That's right, yeah. Right.
Did famous people come to the bear camp? I mean, was it a well-known thing in the States?
Well, of course, this was during the Depression, and so only people that were very wealthy could come on this kind of a hunt, because it was quite lengthy. Most of the people had to travel by train to Seattle, and then there was one ship a month to Kodiak, and so they'd travel to Kodiak and then up to our bear camp, and they would stay for 3 weeks, and so it was a long, long time, and most of the people were, like I say, well-to-do millionaires.
Mm-hmm. People could afford to come here.
Yes, that's right.
Did the Depression affect Kodiak as it may have other places? I mean,
well, definitely. There was very little money in Kodiak. There weren't any jobs. Of course, it was a fishing village of about 450 people, and so the people that still were fishing, but the prices were so low that nobody had any money, and they had to grow vegetables like potatoes and carrots and mm-hmm. turnips in their gardens, and just buy staples like flour and tea and sugar and coffee to the store.
So people lived a subsistence lifestyle?
Right. They shot ducks and put up a lot of salt fish and ate a lot of clams. Nobody went hungry, but it was a pretty monotonous diet, lots of beans and things like that.
Before the Depression, you would have been really young, but do you remember the 20s being an economically boom time for Kodiak? Was fishing very important? Was it commercial fishing important to the community as it is today?
Well, of course, Kodiak was always a fishing community, and we had a cannery here in town where King Crab is now, and everybody in town fished. That was the only industry that we had here other than the school, and business was good as far as the hunting business was concerned up until 1929 when the stock crash happened. And then it became a little bit leaner after that.
How did World War II change Kodiak?
Well, of course, Kodiak started to change before World War II happened because the United States started to build up its defenses in the late 30s, and they came to Kodiak about 1939 and looked the place over and decided that that was a good location for a naval base. And so they started to build the what's now the Coast Guard base about 1940, and so there's a lot of construction going on here and doubled the size of the community immediately with construction workers. And I graduated from high school in 1941, and I worked out on the base. I worked on a tugboat that summer, and then in the fall I left home and went down to Oregon to college. So I wasn't here during the war years. I left in August of 1941, and I didn't come back until January 1946, after the war was over.
Oh, did your father continue his bear camps through those years?
No, there wasn't any hunting during the war years. There was no travel. Travel was restricted. In fact, it was restricted to wartime supplies and things like that, and so the Army and Navy pretty much took over everything on the island and built defenses around there. And my dad had, before the war started, he had made our house into a hotel because it had originally been built as a three-story log house, and he had a general merchandise store in the downstairs. And then when he went into the guiding business, he closed the store down and used it to store all of his tents and stoves and canoes and things like that that he used in his hunting business. And when the only hotel in Kodiak burned down, there was no hotel, so he remodeled the downstairs and made rooms and made it into a hotel. And then when the construction started on the Navy base, he branched out into the curio business. He had a little store, and he had he'd spent a number of years up in the Arctic, and so he had good contacts, and he could buy mufflucks and parkas and all kinds of ivory and things like that, and he used his contact there to keep supplies and sell souvenirs, and so he did that during the war years.
Is that the home that's across from, across catty corner from the Cherry and King building, the house that Markham lives in, or is that?
No, that house, the house that was, that I grew up in, was in the urban renewal district, and it was torn down. It was quite large, and but it's right at the corner across from Kodiak Motors, where the chiropractor is construction.
Oh, yeah, in the bottom of the cherry.
Right, that it would be right there on that corner.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. During the war, you say you were able to go down to Oregon to go to school. How did you travel to get down there if it was restricted?
Well, this was before the war.
Oh,
I left here in August of 1941. Went down to Oregon.
Uh-huh.
On a ship, Alaska steamship.
That was the only way to get out of Kodiak then?
Yes. We didn't have any aircraft in those days.
Uh-huh.
I did go down the year before. I went down in 1940 and I worked on a cannery tender over in Uganic for the summer. And at the end of the season, I went south on the boat that I worked on. It was a 50-foot boat that I used to pick up fish and
uh-huh.
from gill netters around the island. And so I went south. That was my first trip out of Alaska.
It was your first trip?
When I was 17.
Oh. Mm-hmm. So you didn't get on the steamer often, and as we do today, get on the ferry and go for a trip. It wasn't that
long. No, nobody ever did that. No, it was too costly. And
people in the days when you say you were working on a tender, most of the fish was canned or was it salted?
No, it was all canned.
It was all canned?
Right.
And here in Kodiak, or did they take it down?
No, actually, when I worked on the tender, I worked for an outfit called San Juan Fishing and Packing Company in Uganic.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two canneries in Uganic. There was one in Larson Bay and one in Alatak, one in Kodiak.
And did they process it here, or they process it out in the bay? They can it out the canneries out there.
Right. Yeah.
Were the villages in those days much bigger than they are today, like Aukiak and Karlik?
Yes, they were. They were quite a bit larger.
And they had
Old Harbor wasn't as large as it is now.
Mm-hmm.
Fog Neck was quite a large village. In fact, they had three stores in a Fog Neck. We only had two in Kodiak, but wow. A Fog Neck had three stores. So it was quite a bustling community.
So the canneries helped keep the villages going by having, or was it just that there were more people that lived there then?
Well, the people that lived there, they were industrious. They were all fishermen or worked for the canneries.
Mm-hmm. Well, you yourself went fishing when you returned to Kodiak after the war?
Yes, I did.
And where did you fish?
I fished up in Bristol Bay.
For salmon?
For salmon.
And what was that fishery like?
Well, I guess in order to put the story in context, I should tell you that, during the time that I was growing up, every son wanted to emulate his father.
Uh-huh.
And my father had been born in Denmark and left home when he was 14 years old. He was a sailor on a square rigger. He was a sailing ship sailor. Very tough life, and he used to tell stories about sailing around Cape Horn and how tough it was and climbing up in the rigging and things like that. And in growing up in Kodiak, as I told you earlier, it was a very, very small town, and everybody was involved in the fishery locally here. Seining for salmon
uh-huh.
or gill netting, but there were a few people that used to travel to Bristol Bay to fish up there, and they were kind of set apart from the rest of the community. I think they had a little bit of a mystique about them because they made a lot of money in a very short period of time, and up there they still used sailboats. That's all. They didn't allow any power, and so they were just different than the rest of the fishermen in our community.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, they'd come back with stories about the people that they fished up in the bay, the people, I guess Corsicans and people from Sicilians and a lot of Finns from Astoria.
People from San Francisco.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And I recall these men would leave Kodiak and go up to Bristol Bay on the ship
mm-hmm.
that used to stop in Kodiak, and when they'd come back, there would be a lot of excitement in the community, you know, knowing that the Bristol Bay fishermen had come back and they were loaded with money.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, different things that pique your when you're wearing a pair of leather hip boots. And this was not uncommon. I mean, this was the outfit that the Finnish fishermen
used.
Their leather, their hip boots were made out of leather instead of rubber.
Wow.
And you know, things, it was just different.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, my father had been in the Navy, and so I felt like I had to go in the Navy, and I enlisted in the Navy and spent 4 years there during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Then I came back, and I guess I was trying to prove to him that I could be as tough as he was. So instead of fishing locally here, I had an uncle that lived up in Bristol Bay, and I wrote to him and asked him if he could find me a job on one of the boats up there.
Mm-hmm.
And he did. So I went up to Bristol Bay to fish on a sailboat.
Wow.
Instead of using power, and that's how I got involved in fishery.
Did you do it several years in a row, or
well, this was in 1948, I think it was my first year up there.
Mm-hmm.
And the fellow that I was fishing with was a man in his 70s. He was an Estonian, and he had a master's license in sail and steam, so he was an excellent sailor. But he was also a heavy drinker, and so he had a hard time finding partners. And that's how come I was able to get on board with him. And he never left the cannery without a fifth under his arm. And we'd sail out in any kind of weather. When many times I recall when it would be blowing like mad there, and my partner would come and say, "Come on, Roy, we're going out," and we'd get on the boat, and my uncle would be standing on the dock and saying, "Don't go out with that damn fool, you're going to get drowned." Nobody else would be going out except us, but we would reef the sail down real so there was hardly any, just enough to keep us moving, and we'd sail out there. And this boat was 32 feet long, and we lived on it, you know, when we were away from the cannery. It didn't have a cabin on it.
I was
going
to say, they're like open
They're open
skiffs,
boats,
aren't
right?
they?
But we'd put the mast down, and we'd put the sail over the mast, and slept in our clothes.
Like
and,
a little tent,
right,
sort of?
Yeah, made a tent out of it, and we cooked on a Swede stove,
mm-hmm.
ate nothing but canned food.
How did you fish? Did you fish with nets or
yeah,
control?
With gill nets.
With gill nets.
Yeah, drift gill nets. You'd put out, we had three shackles of gear, about 900 feet of nets, and put those things up and then let the tide carry us out to sea.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd pull them in and take the fish out and put them back out again and drift back in with the tide. And then we'd go up, and they had scows that were anchored out in the bay, and we'd sail up to one of the scows and unload our fish.
You showed me a picture of a whole line of sailboats being towed back. Why were they being towed back to shore?
Well, about twice a week they'd have closures, and so during the closures, instead of staying out there in these boats that didn't have any accommodations,
mm-hmm.
We had little tugboats that would tow us into the cannery, and we could take a shower and eat at the cannery,
mm-hmm.
instead of eating out of cans. And so.
What was the most scariest experience you had with this crazy drunk 70-year-old fisherman that you went out with?
Well, believe it or not, we used to do a lot of night fishing. We'd put our nets out and we'd drift and drift and drift, and on this particular occasion, we drifted all night, and when I get up in the morning, I couldn't see any land. Of course,
uh-oh.
It's very flat out there, and there was no wind, so we couldn't sail. And like I told you, the boat's 32 feet long. We had two pair of 14-foot oars, and you had to put a board across a thwartship,
mm-hmm.
and stand up on the thing and row. And I rowed that boat all day long, and I don't think hardly made any progress at all, but there wasn't any wind, and we were...
You were drifting out in the middle of the Bering Sea, weren't you?
Right, yeah.
You were out of the bay by then, weren't you?
But finally, some wind came up, and we started to sail, and then pretty soon we could see the land, and we sailed back in.
How many years did you go fishing out
there? Well, I just fished 2 years. The first year that I fished up there, we had a terrible, terrible storm, and 14 of the fishermen were drowned, which was a terrific amount. They'd get their boats loaded, and the boats would swamp, and of course the water is very silty, and if you dressed so warm, you had to... Well, what I wore was heavy wool underwear, a wool shirt, wool pants, and then I wore a sheepskin coat over my wool shirt, hip boots, and oilskins on top of that.
Wow.
And we didn't have any life jackets on the boats, and so if you fell in, you just went right to the bottom. Your clothes would fill up with sand, and a lot of times at night, we didn't have any lights on the boats, and a power boat would come down, crash right into one, and turn it over, cut it in two, or something like that. So there's a lot of boats that were lost. Or they'd go aground on a sandbar.
Mm-hmm.
It's very shallow up there, like Cook Inlet, and it's muddy. When you went ashore, you couldn't get out, and you just had to wait for the tide to come in. It's very strong and heavy tides. And so there was a lot of men lost, and I questioned my sanity the first year, but I went back for a second year.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the fishing finished for the summer, I decided I wasn't going to fish anymore, and decided to leave Alaska and go back to school.
What kind of prices or crew shares did you get in those days? I mean, I know the economy was different, but...
Well, we got paid 25 cents for a red salmon.
Per pound or
no,
per fish?
Per fish.
Wow.
And 75 cents for a king salmon.
And any other species caught besides reds and kings?
No, just reds and kings.
Up there?
Right.
And
I think that the most I ever made, and I used to go up there before the fishing season started, and I would work when the ships would come in with the supplies for the cannery. I would longshore, and then I would stay after the season was over and longshore, loading all the canned salmon onto the ships and cleaning up the boats at the end of the season and everything like that, because my uncle was the head of a beach gang, and I think the most I made was $2,300. Working June, July, and August, about 3 months.
When you came back to Kodiak in those years, and before you went to Oregon to go to school, did you find a work in Kodiak?
Oh, yes. I used a longshore here, too.
Longshore.
I did that during the summer months, and then in the winter time, I worked in Kraft's Men's Store.
Oh.
And so I worked the year round. Then I guided in the spring and fall with my father.
So your father still had his...
Yes. I got a guide's license, and I used to go out with him. I'd go out around the 1st of April and guide until June, and then I'd go to Bristol Bay, fish until August, and then I'd longshore until September and go back out guiding from September to November, and I worked in Kraft's Men's Store from November till April.
Well, you were supporting a family then.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
you had Aliza and Mary Jane born by this time?
Yeah.
So, in those early days, was king crab ever caught?
No.
There was no inkling of.
Well, believe it or not, I first saw a king crab when I was about 6 or 7 years old. One of our neighbors brought a king crab over to our house and gave it to us, and I remember. We had it in a room in a wash tub, and that thing was sitting there with the legs hanging over the edge of the wash tub, and that was the first and only king crab that I saw until I came back here in 1961. They must have been here. but I never saw it.
It wasn't a part of the native diet. I mean,
no,
it was probably too hard to catch, maybe, or
no.
The last question I was going to ask you this evening, I think, was fisheries has always been important to Kodiak, and your father's bear. Oh no, I was going to ask you. Change that question. Never mind. Oh, did your father's bear guiding business have a peak? I mean, was there a time when it was really having a booming day? For example, after the war, did he have a real successful the guiding business? Did it reach success and continue on until his death, or did it fall off after a certain number of years?
After World War II, when he took up guiding again, I think it was in 1946, it was very successful up until the time he died in 1954. He had, the hunts were 2 weeks and he had his own boat. He used to take the parties on his own boat, and his boats got successively larger. So he had a 42-foot boat, then he had a 65-foot boat, then he had a 96-foot boat. So
he was real successful.
Yes.
Tell me some more about your fishing experiences.
Fished up in Bristol Bay in 1948-1949, just after I left the fishery, they passed a law that permitted them to use power, and so in 1950, I think it was a year after I left, or 1951, they started to put power in the boats. And
what was the reason for not letting them use?
Here's a picture. It's conservation.
Oh.
Because the water is real muddy, like it is in Cook Inlet,
and
silty,
shallow,
and if they permitted power, they were afraid that the boats would just wipe out the fishery. And of course, you've probably read about the record fishery they had the last couple of years, so they managed to sustain their yield very well. It's a very valuable fishery still. But the first attempt at power, they put a outboard on one of those sailboats, and that didn't work very well. The outboard motor was added without success, and so then they start building little boats specifically for Bristol Bay, and then bring them up on a big ship.
Would the ship be the tender eventually, or
no? That was a freighter that it would bring the supplies up and then take the pack back down in the fall, because they didn't have any place to store the boats. The canneries had their own place there, but these were brand new, and so they were built in Seattle. And the original boats that I fished in were called Columbia River boats, because they originated on the Columbia River. That's the kind of boats that they fished in on the Columbia River here in the 30s.
They're mostly double-enders? And
double-enders, right.
Both ends are pointed?
Right.
And so did the power, adding power to the fishery, did it make for smaller catches because there were more boats, or they were faster and they filled? Did they have quotas in those days?
No, they didn't have quotas. Just whatever the cannery could process is what they allowed them to catch, and I can't recall ever the canneries being so full up that they wouldn't take fish.
And so did the fishery change much when with the advent of power?
Oh, very much. It has changed tremendously, because the original boats were just modifications of the little 32-footers, and now they're built so that, in fact, some of the boats are built that they're larger than 32 feet, but they can take the bow off of them, a detachable bow, and they're very, very wide, so that they've got all kinds of room, and they have power rollers. Like when I was fishing, you pulled the net over the stern roller by hand. Now they have power rollers and they have big drums that the nets go on, so they just haul them up like that. Everything's by power nowadays, and it's much easier.
That's probably what Bristol Bay still is, a lucrative fishing ground.
Very.
The permits out there are probably very expensive, worth a lot.
Oh, yes. I think the last that I heard, something like $250,000 for a permit.
Wow. That's a lot. That could be somebody's whole season.
That's right. The boats are, probably, the modern boats probably sell for around $250,000. All kinds of electronic gear on them, and they're very comfortable quarters that can live right on them.
During that time here in Kodiak, did they have a seine fishery?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And has that always been in existence since they've had power of boats?
Yes. They had little seiners. You know, they when I was a kid, the seiners were probably about 34 feet long, and as things have progressed, they have what they call the limit is
right.
58 foot, so they have 58 foot water. The boats are 58 foot limit seiners, and they're $750,000.
Right now.
Right, and they have big power skips too.
Right.
And their nets are much bigger because they seine off of the capes around the island, and